St. John, I'm an alcoholic. I'm inviting to the grace of God in this program, and you people, I haven't had a drink since the 18th of October, 1971, and for that I'm very grateful. What can I say about Atlanta, right? I mean, I haven't been back since. it's happy birthday, 202 Group. Happy 8 years. Congratulations, and good to be a part of your event here. Yesterday, John S., a friend of mine, and I went down to a meeting at Preston at noon, and it was one of my better days. Everything seemed to be going my way, and I couldn't get my phone to work very well, so I started throwing it at it, the receiver at the phone in the car as we were driving to the meeting. And John and I had scheduled, I hope I'm not betraying any confidence, he's wanted to do a little fist-up work on John today, he's going to meet this afternoon to work on that. And after I threw the phone at the phone a few times, John suggested maybe we might want to do my fist-up today instead of his fist-up. And I thought that was rather appropriate. and so I've invited him to go to Atlanta with me next. I hear the preface read from the big book, I just really love it because it says in there, you know, it says we are not saints, right? And I'm continually amazed that alcoholics seem to be the only people that need to remind themselves they're not saints. I don't know about you, but no one accused me of being a saint today, and nor yesterday. Or since I had been toting my 95 IQ. The other thing that I thought was interesting when I was hearing the traditions, right? I suppose I'd have that done more often because then I would know what's in them. But they talked about AA as such ought never be organized. I don't really see organization as a threat, do you? I don't see as getting together and doing anything other than getting together, you know, maybe start a rock pile or something, but it's good to be here, it's good to be sober, and it's good to be here with Bill P., even getting to share, Bill, I told you, don't mess with the second speaker, right? And it's good to be involved in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, something that I probably find interesting that I even think that now. I mean, for the longest time, I was so caught up in my own selfishness, the fact that I would be involved in any other organization or anything that required any of my time or attention was just something that I couldn't cope with. I mean, it was just beyond my wildest dreams. And then to take an organization like Alcoholics Anonymous and then to be excited about it, I find that to be in this category up here of the miracles. So it's fun to be here and to be involved in the deal. I think the beautiful thing about being sober is that that one can think back, you know, to how it used to be and what it was like. And I like to reflect on that. For example, I drove over with John S. tonight, and I know right where he parked the car. And when we leave here, we're going to walk right to it. You know what I mean? And we're not going to crawl around the parking lot a while, throw up a few times, find some car and drive it home. We're going to get in his wife's car and drive it home, and neither one of us probably will throw up. Any event, it's a lot less exciting, I suppose, than it was when I was drinking, but nonetheless, any event, things like memory and knowing what I did earlier today and not coming from behind and not owing a lot of apologies and not having to try to dig out of a lot of crap, which is kind of the trademark of how I used to live. I think back, though, as I say, and with hanging around AA and a relatively clear mind from time to time, I get to reflect back on how life used to be and the type of person that I was. And the more I think about that, the more I believe it's really good I became an alcoholic, you know? Because alcohol seemed to, when I first started drinking alcohol, I thought it was actually a major event in my life, a major step forward, you know what I mean, a major accomplishment. It seemed to fix in me some things that apparently that were broke, at least in my opinion were broke, And its effect on them was so subtle and yet significant that years later, when it's killing me and people are pointing out to me how it's killing me, I still wouldn't look at it. I wouldn't see it. But I think back about sitting in meetings like this and hearing speakers get up and talk, and they used to stand at the podium and they'd say, I drank essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And I would sit out there, and I was really big on disidentifying with speakers. You know, I wasn't going to get sucked into that deal. You know what I mean? This cult AA deal, you know, with your big book and handshake and everything else. And I would sit out there and I'd disidentify with them, because I really didn't want to be part of this leper colony, as my sponsor used to refer to it as. And they said they drank essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. And I said, well, that's good, because I didn't. I drank because I happen to like the taste of alcohol, and I just get drunk incidentally. You know what I mean? Doing what I happen to like the taste of. And I believe that. You know, that's part of the crime of alcoholism, I guess, is a lot of the crap that I bought along the way in order to get to keep doing the things that I kept doing. But again, as I say, hanging around the program, eventually comes a degree of honesty, or some honesty creeps in, and it occurred to me that when I think back to the first drinks I had, there was a kid growing up in my kitchen, my father sitting at the table having a beer on a Saturday afternoon and reading the newspaper, and you're a kid, you go running through the house and he'd have the beer sitting there, and I'd grab a glass of beer and have a drink. My first experience with any kind of alcohol. And if the beer was ice cold, you know, who can taste anything cold, right? It's just carbonated, you know that. But if it had sat on the table a while and had reached room temperature so that you could experience the full bouquet of Falstaff, you know, it's awful stuff. I mean, Falstaff was rotten. And I don't know if it's just limited to Falstaff. You know, why does anybody drink this stuff? If you're a kid, you don't hang around. You don't want to know any answers. You know, you just throw out questions and leave. And that's what I did, and I'd take off. Well, years later, I found out why people drank that stuff, and it was the effect produced on it. And the effect was something, as I say, it seemed to me that it was important for me to fit in and to belong and to be accepted, because those are the things that I continually ran around trying to do and couldn't seem to get them done. Yet if I had a few drinks, it seemed to work out okay, you know? If I didn't have a few drinks and I'd go up and meet some people and say, John, like me, Bill, Mary, and Charlie. Bill, Mary, and Charlie, this is John. I'd say thank you. Or something totally inappropriate. I'd feel awful. I would feel that they would go, oh, what a dope, you know? And they'd go on talking about whatever the hell they were talking about before I got there. However, if I had a few drinks, I would go up there, Bill, Mary, and Charlie. I'd say something. It would be cute, slick, or something. And they might laugh, and I'd say, oh, John, he's a hell of a guy. Come on in. You know what I mean? And I would be part of the deal. And apparently that was important to me. And so that's kind of how it started out. Alcohol at first was not a major problem. At least I don't believe it was. However, every time I went out and drank, well, there was no limit on how much I drank, I got drunk. You know what I mean? At the beginning, when we would go out, there's not a lot of rules, there's not a lot of books out there on how to live, at least there never used to be. Now there's a ton of them. But at least there never used to be a lot of books on what do normal people do, and is it this is acceptable behavior. And if there were those books, I'm sure I wouldn't have read them. But I know that I would get in circumstances and in situations, and alcohol seemed to serve me well. We would go out to eat. Patricia and I would go out to have a drink. Maybe go out to eat and have a drink. And Patricia's beautiful lady. We've been married for a long time. I love her to death. We'd go out to dinner and we'd have a few drinks. And Patricia, if she got into a conversation with someone, she might not finish her drink. You know. And I, on the other hand, was a bar drinker. I thought anything that ever happened in the world happened worthwhile happened in a bar. The greatest thoughts of the world occurred in bars, you know. Among heavy thinkers like myself, 95 IQs hanging around bars, and Patricia would sit there and converse with these people all night. I like to have it. My drink was about half empty. I like the next one ordered and in the system. You know what I mean? So that when I finished it, the next drink would be delivered. You know what I mean? And if that was the, if we had that established in the bar, then I'm ready to chat all night. You know what I mean? I want to talk then, because we can solve some heavy issues. But if that's not going to be the delivery mechanism, I don't want to talk to anybody. I want to leave, you know what I mean, and go somewhere else. It started out, as I say, alcohol was not a problem at first, because I kept thinking I was like other people, you know what I mean, and that I would have a drink from time to time, and then I would go home and do what people do when they got home. And so what I would do is stop off at a bar. I used to think it was so slick to get off work and say, let's stop at a bar and have a couple of drinks before we go home. It sounded like such a great idea, you know, except I never could get out of the damn place once I got there, you know. And what I would say is, let's stop off and have a couple of drinks. What I really meant was, let's stop off at this bar and let's drink till we're both broke, until we can't pass any more paper and we can't hawk anything. And then we run out of money and people. Let's see if we can find our homes and see if somebody will take us back in. But you can't do that, because that sounds antisocial, doesn't it? It sounds somewhat bizarre. So what we say instead is, let's stop off and have a couple of drinks. But what I mean is, you know, and if you've been with me once before and you say yeah, you mean it too. You know what I mean? Because you wouldn't say yeah, you know. And so I'd get in these things, and I couldn't get the hell out of these things. And I met some of the people instantly. You know what I mean? I feel like Spock on Star Trek, where minds would just meld. You know what I mean? We would just come together, and we would have instant communication, and we would understand each other. And then when I would get home, then things would not be so good, because I'm 5 or 6 hours late, right? And here's the pot roast. Here's evidence you're 5 or 6 hours late. It's carbon 12, you know, and we'd get in arguments, and then I'd say, well, I'm not going to do that again. And then the major, these are the minor things, and the major blots seemed to come about a year apart. And these are the events where I'd get out and I'd get tore up and I'd get rolled in East St. Louis and I'd get my eyes blackened, and they'd steal my watch and I'd steal my sport coat and took my shoes. Somebody had a size, needed a size 10 that night, you know. Things, those are major events, you know, and they took my paycheck. You know, we're living from week to week, and that's a big problem when you don't have any money and you got 7 more days to do. And because I just lost it on East St. Louis. By the time I was coming home from the Aerospace Lounge, and Bill P. and I were talking about bars and joints in St. Louis, and the Aerospace Lounge is in the 60s, and I bet every city had an Aerospace Lounge or putting up Sputniks and things like that then. And I was in the Aerospace Lounge, and I was stopped off for a couple of drinks, and it was now closing time. And they told me to, you know, it was time to leave. And they're serious about that. They got a license. It's a business to them, you know. And we just think, oh, come on, one more. And even I got in my car, and I was driving down Brown Road. And I guess the real insanity of this event is the fact that it took me, I drove about a mile before I realized I had a problem with my car. You know what I mean? That it wasn't running right, you know. And what it wasn't running right was I had a flat tire. You know what I mean? And so I pulled over, and I'm drunk, and I'm stumbling around, and it's starting to rain a little bit, and it's about 2:30 in the morning, and I got the car jacked up, and I left the door open on the street side inadvertently, and I went around to close the door, and I noticed I had a flat tire on the other side, too. I had 2 flat tires. You know what I mean? And it's 3 in the morning. I mean, you know, I need to be at home now. You know what I mean? I'm tired. I'm weary, and had a hard night, and I got 2 flat tires, and as I jokingly say, it's like data overload. You know, I just what do? I have 1 spare and 2 flat tires. You know, today I don't know how to solve that one, but that night I know how I solved it. I got in the car and left, and I drove away, And as I didn't take the car off the jack, I didn't do anything. I just drove away, you know. And I again jokingly say that, you know, at first the rubber makes a hell of a racket because it slaps as it goes around. But then after a couple of miles, the rubber goes away. And then it's steel against concrete. And I was on Highway 270. I wasn't going very fast. You can't go very fast without rubber on a tire, you know. But I had this huge rooster tail with sparks shooting out the back of the car, and you'd see a glow on the horizon, and then you'd hear me. And And then I pulled it into the driveway, and it's 3:30 now, and I'm the guy that, you know, came home in the Caterpillar thread car. And the one thing to drive home with a joint at 3 in the morning with no rubber in the back of your car, quite another thing to drive to work the next morning without any rubber in the back of your car. Sit at a stop sign sipping coffee saying, I'm going to get some tires this weekend. I hear they're on sale. You know what I mean? No one does that. No one. I've never seen anyone at 8 o'clock in the morning driving around without rubber on the back of the tires. I just don't see it. And so what I did was not touch that car. I wouldn't get near that car the next day. I called the tow truck and said, you got to come and get this car. And they came and towed it away. I, of course, didn't call my boss. I had the flu that day. Like Norm Alpe used to say, I flew under the bed. You know, I felt so bad. And I mean, it's awful. It's one thing to be drunk and hungover. It's another thing to know what a complete horse's ass I just made of myself the night before. And that just kind of, it's kind of like a tidal wave. Here it comes. You know what I mean? There's no place to hide from the knowledge of what a jerk I was. You know, and it just kind of rolls in. And Patricia would come in and she'd give me a pep talk about, driving around like that, getting in late. And we'd have these incredible arguments and just screaming and hollering and fighting. And it was just awful. What can I say? You know, it's the life of an alcoholic. Things went so well in St. Louis that I got a job offer to come to Dallas, and I took the job in a minute because I needed to leave St. Louis. You know, and we drove down here. For some reason, we both thought that this would be different in Dallas. And in St. Louis, was awful. But for some reason, if we went to Dallas, it was to be a fresh start. You know, we could start over and things would be okay. And I perfectly, logically concluded that I'd be able to drink in Dallas. Just because I had some problems in St. Louis, just because I landed in a psychiatric ward for 2 weeks in St. Louis, solely as a result of my drinking. Just because I picked up a little Librium habit, you know, along the way on non-addictive Librium and the wonder drug of the 60s, that wouldn't be a problem in Dallas. I don't know why that seems so normal to conclude that, you know. And what really kind of offended me is when I got to AA and I told them that I thought when I moved to Dallas I'd be able to drink here. And I remember Jack Lake, when he was alive, he got this, geographical cure. It really offended me that I was so garden variety of an alcoholic profile that I was just filling it out. You know what I mean? I mean, it wasn't like I couldn't, you know what I mean? Wait on your judgments, Jack. So we came to Dallas and I thought things would be better. And, of course, you know the answer to that story. Things went from bad to worse because I was still drinking. And I was still taking my Librium because I had a nervous disposition. Otherwise, a nice guy, as the book says. You know, I didn't work at an auto agency, but other than that, the stories are similar. I had a nervous disposition because I used to drink alcohol and then abruptly stop. I submit that makes you very nervous. You know what I mean? My brain had its own agenda, and my arms and feet did something else. And they didn't particularly give a damn what kind of nerve impulses were being sent down. And so I found Librium to be helpful, except I never knew the dosage with Librium. They said it's a harmless drug. It's completely self-regulating. Matter of fact, my prescription was refill ad lib at Liberty, and I refilled it at Liberty. And so I took this for a while, and it's had its whole world of side effects that, I dwell on them on the one hand, but I don't know if it's necessary. I mean, for one, I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever experienced this. I seem to just miss things, you know what I mean, like doorways, you know what I mean? Ever since I've been off Librium, before Librium and after Librium, I've never had a problem walking through a doorway. With Librium, I just nicked them. Didn't hit him, miss him bad, I'd nick him. You know what I mean? Same thing, sitting in a chair. Just miss it. You know what I mean? And sit on the floor. Or do something worse, kind of half catch it. You know what I mean? Where you look like an octopus sitting down. You got legs and arms going everywhere. And this is at a time where I'm not trying to draw attention to myself. I'm very self-conscious. And I'm doing my, flying Houdini routine in the middle of crowded rooms. And then I'd be sitting in my office. I worked in a bullpen type of office arrangement in St. Louis, worked for a big bomber company. And there's 315 of us in a room with wall-to-wall desks jammed against each other. And something would go to fall off my desk, and in my attempt to grab this piece of paper falling off my desk, I cleared everything else off my desk. You know? And so, anyway, so I wanted this stuff for a while, and the worst 6 months of my life was when I got out of the psychiatric ward, taking the medication, and not going to AA. It was awful. It was the worst thing I've ever done, is not drink, take Librium, and be in charge. That's hell. I just define hell. As Clancy says, alcoholics really become psychotic. We go back to drinking, you know, and so I did, and I went back. I couldn't stand the pain of not drinking, of living life without drinking. I went back to drinking, and then, of course, we're in Dallas, and things are unfolding, and it's getting really crappy, and Patricia and I are, I mean, we're living just two sick people living together, and we have only each other for counsel. And we counsel with each other when we scream at each other, you know, and we're fighting. And she cries a lot, and I try to leave a lot. And that's kind of how we lived for years. And we didn't know that was abnormal, because who do you go talk to about that? Don't talk to anybody about stuff like that until you come to AA, and you find out everybody's talking about it. Now, in that day, they used to do it. You know what I mean? And then they're talking about it, and they're in the solution, you know. And they're talking about solutions, and they're not doing it. They're laughing and joking. And they used to say things to me like, don't drink, John, and things would get better. And I wouldn't drink, and things really got crappy. And I kept thinking, we have a different disease. I quit drinking, and things get awful. You quit drinking, and you get promotions. You know what I mean? You quit drinking, and you sit in a chair. That's the thing that really stuck in my mind most about Alcoholics Anonymous when I finally came back here. Is the fact that I could think back on the 18th of October, 1971, I was in my one-room apartment. I reflected back on the people in AA. And what I remembered was, you would sit in a chair. I was really impressed with that. You would sit in a chair and look relaxed. And I couldn't do that. At the end of my drinking, I couldn't sit anywhere longer than 10 minutes. And I'd sit there and I'd say, if I sit here another minute, I'm coming apart. I have to get up and walk, and I'd get up and I'd pace, and I'd sweat, and I'd do this for 10 minutes. And I'd say, I am so exhausted, if I don't sit down, I'm going to pass out. And I'd sit down. 10 minutes, I'm coming apart. I reached a point where I couldn't put myself somewhere for a period of time and be happy with it. It was up or down or sideways or cross town or get in a car or let's move, and the nerves are firing, and they're doing their own thing, and my brain's loving it. You know, and it was just chaos, and I couldn't stand it. And I thought back about the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you people just sitting here, you know, and you're sitting here relaxed, and you're laughing, and your laugh is spontaneous. And that's the thing that I remembered about it. I kind of jumped ahead, but I want to jump a little bit ahead. Needless to say, from the time we moved down here in November of 69 till about August of 71, my drinking progressed and things became insane, okay? And when I first married Patricia, my drinking was a problem. Her mom, I want to tell my one quantifying alcoholic story. And that is the only place I've ever heard it before described about getting drunk, how often, and frequency, and alcoholism. First year we were married, her mother-in-law, and I think she's a neat lady, by the way, because she was my champion even when things were crappy. But her mother-in-law sent Patricia, my mother-in-law sent my wife, a newspaper article that said, 4 toots a year and you're out. Bad title, bad article, I assure you. Because the thrust of the whole article was that if you get drunk, you ready for this now, 4 times a year, you got a problem drinking. I'm thinking here, wait a minute now. This is obviously a misprint. Because at that stage of my life, and that's early, the early stage of my life, I'm thinking it's probably 4 times a month. What they really mean is 4 times a week, because I could still get under 4 times a week. I thought with discipline I could get under 4 times a month, but I wasn't making 4 times a month. And what he's saying is 4 times a year. That's incredible, isn't it? Now I think about my wife. Again, a beautiful lady. I only bring this up to draw a distinction. She's a social drinker, okay? And we've been married 29 years. And I've gone with her for 2 years before we got married. So I've known the woman 31 years. And in 31 years, the number of times that I know that Patricia has gotten drunk is 2. So her drunk rate, 2 over 30, 115. Right? Every one out of every 15 years, she gets hopelessly taken drunk. You know what I mean? And I can't make 4 extra year. You see what I mean? There's a difference, isn't there? It's a startling difference, okay? She could tear it up from now on, and her average would still be well under the comfort zone. And I'm burnt out of my average the first year. You know, so there's a big difference between us and them, at least for that. The other thing I like to point out, and I heard a speaker mention, he says that when you hear people say these words, you know you're talking to an alcoholic. And the words are, I can control it. You know? And I didn't know that, because Patricia's never had to say at once every 15 years, John, I can control it, because I don't even care. And it's a non-issue between her and I about her once every 15-year blowout. You know what I'm saying? I, on the other hand, a lot of people are wanting to pull me aside and chat with me, you know, and say, John, I'd like to bring up the fact about driving home, I'm tired. They didn't even know about that one. You know what I mean? They want to talk about other things, you know. So it's a big problem. And I always respond, I can control it. And I didn't know. I just said, I'm an alcoholic to these people. Now, an alcoholic's not a problem with control. It's sort of like me drinking water. I mean, I could go lean on a drinking fountain right now, and I may or may not have a drink. And if I did have a drink, I won't spend the rest of the evening sucking on the fountain. You know what I'm saying? I'll probably go to my car after I get my thirst quenched. You know what I mean? Something mundane like that. I kind of suspect that's how non-alcoholics think about alcohol. It's casual to them. Whereas with me, it's deliberate. It's intentional. I'm here with the booze, and I planned it that way. You know what I mean? And if I'm here and there ain't no booze, I made a big mistake. You know what I mean? And I'm not going to hang around to see how it's going to get fixed, because I'm going to fix it. I'm going to go somewhere else. You know, I'm going to go out to my car. You know, we don't get stranded that often. Any event, like hanging in and out of the steel, and everything's upside down and crazy. Patricia and I screaming and fighting. We're living the alcoholic nightmare. And Patricia's going to some Al-Anon meetings, and I'm going to some AA meetings, and it's just kind of, you know, I'm staying drunk, and Patricia's going to her meetings. And then all of a sudden, she learns what they teach them, or learns something about what they teach them in Al-Anon, because she quit playing, you know. And I'd come home from these blowouts, and Patricia wasn't at the door to jump me about where you've been and who you've been doing it with. She was in bed, sleeping, at least acting like she's sleeping. And I used to always think it was awful to have to go home and face her, until I found out I didn't have to face her. Then I went looking for her. You know what I mean? Patricia, I want to tell you what occurred to me walking home. And the reason I was walking home is because she came and took the car from the bar that I was in. You know, we had one car, and we played a lot of hide the car. We played hide the checkbook. We played hide the credit card. We played all the alcoholic games people play. So I'd go look for her, and we'd have these discussions. And she'd say, John, I don't want to talk about it. We'll talk about it in the morning. And I hated talking about it in the morning. I thought I always wanted to talk about it in the morning because she wanted to do it. Anyway, this kind of clash goes on like this, and then I'm getting a little more insane in my alcoholism, and she's getting a little healthy, and she's talking to some other people. And then the next thing you know, I had another blowout, is how I like to describe them. And when I came home, I was kind of getting a little bizarre and tearing up the place. And she became afraid for herself and for our 2 children. And she went to see Judge Richburg, the law, Blessed of the Trinity, when he was alive. And Judge Richburg said that I needed to leave my house. And I thought, that's awful. But I knew he couldn't run me out of my house. But he said he's going to put me in jail if I didn't leave my house. What I really think he had in mind was that I'll just put him in jail and it'll take him a couple of days to sort it out. And then he'll get out because he shouldn't be in there. And what alcoholics ever caused a judge grief? You know what I mean? After he's gotten out of jail. We may go hate him real hard. You know what I mean? But we're never going to get around to suing him. We can't put anything together like that. I mean, that requires concentrated effort for longer than 10 minutes. And an alcoholic, the only thing I can concentrate on then is, where am I getting another drink? And when I get another drink, I can always go hate them, you know, and that's good enough for me. Anyway, I knew it was going to happen, and I didn't want to be in jail 5 minutes, much less 2 days. And so as a result of that, I had this fear. I had my own theory of sobering up. I was of the taper-off school of quit drinking. You know what I mean? That when I get around to not drinking, I like to taper off. You know, I didn't like to abruptly stop and get sober and then hop and jump and hear the radio and hear all the sounds. But I always kind of thought if you tapered off, you wouldn't go through that withdrawal crap, you know. Of course, the risk with tapering off is tapering back on, you know what I mean? And if you get into that cycle, they call it a binge after a while. But I knew in jails they didn't let you use the tapering off technique. You know what I mean? And since that was my favorite, I didn't want to go there, even for 2 days. And so when he said leave, I left. And I got myself in an apartment not far from here, over on Bowser, as a matter of fact. And it was only one room. I had a little bit more in mind when I was getting away from that family and that responsibility and all that. Just that responsibility. It was just like a big rock out there. You know what I mean? It was mine to drag around the rest of life. And that's kind of how I viewed it. And so I got out and got my own place. And for the next 3 months, I drank. You know, I didn't have to worry about getting up in the morning. There were times when I got up in the morning that I would like to have a drink before I went to work. Because if I drank before I went to work, I could then shave, tie my shoes and my tie, and get the hell out of the house, which was my goal every morning. You know, but if I didn't get to drink in the morning at this stage, then I couldn't do that stuff, you know, and it felt awful. And Patricia, this last game we played a lot of, she used to like to catch me drinking in the morning so she could call me an alcoholic to my face. Confrontational thing that she is, you know. And so what we would, and also Patricia is gifted with great ears. If someone sneezed in Siberia, she would know it. And so what I would do is I'd get up at 6 o'clock on a Monday morning, and I'd be out in the kitchen, and I'd take a little bitty cushion off the couch, and I'd put it over a beer can. Top of it, you know. And she would hear that gas escaping. And I knew I had, what, 2 or 3 seconds to get the contents of that beer can into me before she came around the corner. And so I just... then I'd open it up and just dump it, you know, and just pour it down. And the first beer of the morning, whether it's warm or cold, has a tendency to come back up. But you can't stop. You know what I mean? If you're drinking for effect, you don't stop. It's coming out your nose, but keep pouring in your mouth. And just drinking for effect. And then Patricia come running around the corner, and she'd go, "You alcoholic." Just contempt dripping off her voice. You know? And what do you say to that? "I'm not." I mean, you say, "I didn't want a cup of coffee. I thought I'd guzzle a warm beer this morning before I went to work." How do you get around that? She won that one, and she loved to win that one. You know, and this is the game we started the week with. And so I figured in my own place, I didn't put up with that crap. And guess what? You don't have to put up with that crap. You don't put up with anything, because after a while, nobody comes around. And that's kind of how it got to be. I got my own place, and David A. says if an alcoholic isn't going to get something else to drink, he's not going anywhere. As much as I didn't like that when I first heard it, it's true. So I drank my own place for the next 2 or 3 months till the 18th of October. I remember the weekend before I quit drinking. I remember the day I quit drinking. I could still remember how it smelled out. It rained the whole Saturday and Sunday before that Monday on the 18th, It wasn't the worst drunk I'd ever been on by any means. It was just another day out in the life of a drunk, you know. I drank a Saturday, and I drank Sunday, and I was driving home Sunday night. I was driving home Saturday night, and I was going out the tollway. I hit a curb, bent the wheel on my car again. Beer can exploded in the car. I got beer dripping off the headliner, and I... bent wheel, and I said, "God, if there's a policeman within 1,000 miles of me, I'm dead." And I drove the car home like that. I forgot, got out in the heavy rain. I left the headlights on, so the next day I got up on a Sunday, the battery was dead, And I got a bent wheel and another whiskey den on the side. And Sunday night, I'm out of everything. I'm out of beer. I'm out of cigarettes. And so all I want to do is get down on Greenville Avenue, get some beer, get some cigarettes. Not a lot to ask, right? And but in order to do that, I had to write a hot check. I didn't have any money to buy any beer or cigarettes with on Greenville. So I wrote a hot check for $10, which would have covered it in those days. And I went out to my car, and the battery's dead. So I called the auto club. Get the auto club out. Say, hey, look, you know, my wife's, she's not here right now, and she's got our auto club card. And so can I write you a check? He goes, I'll take cash, buddy. And so I had to give him the cash I just wrote the $10 hot check for. And then leave the car running, go find my neighbor, see if he'll take another check for $10. Drive the hell down on Greenville Avenue with my bent wheel, park the car, leave the engine running, run in, two zigzags, two. Drive the hell back to my apartment, shut the car down. I don't know if it's going to run the next day. And I'm back to my apartment to relax on Sunday evening. I spent 3 hours going out to get 2 six-packs of beer. That's the logistics it reached in my life, just to do anything. It got to be a chore, right? I needed to line up resources and talent and time just to get my car down on Greenville. I was exhausted when I got back. And so I got back, and I was having a few drinks the next day. I got up. It was the 18th of October. I was supposed to go to work. and I don't know what happened this day, but somewhere I started out drinking, I know that, and then I had about 10 minutes of some of the most lucid thinking I've ever had in my life. And in that 10 minutes, it became very clear to me that I was sitting here in my one-bedroom apartment, my one-room apartment. I was the most lonely, afraid, miserable person that I knew. I couldn't think of anybody that was worse off than me in all those categories. I mean, I didn't ever... The thought of turning off a light, I mean, the lights were on 24 hours a day in my room. I couldn't stand darkness, I didn't want a shadow to be anywhere around. And I was so uptight about this. And it became apparent to me that I was lonely, afraid, and miserable because I was an alcoholic. And that wasn't the crime. I've been in and out of AA a lot up till now. I've been in and out of AA for 2-3 years now. I'm the handball of the program, I'm in and out all the time. I'm the kind of guy, I was the guy that if you were working with somebody, you didn't want them hanging around with me. You wanted them to stick with the winners. The guy that you said, if you're working with somebody, you said, you need to work the steps or you're going to turn out like Diggins. I'd say that facetiously, but there's a lot of truth in that, too. And so, on the 18th of October, it occurred to me that the people in the program perhaps were right, all of my smart alecky attitude towards you people, was misplaced. And so I called once again to the Preston group, and they sent out two more, troops, out to... And the people that came was Wade and Clayton became my sponsor. And Clayton is today my sponsor, and I thank the world to him. And he was married to Babs at the time, and they were critical people in my development and my sobriety, and they taught me an awful lot, and I'm ever so indebted to them. but this night on the 18th of October, Clayton and Wade came out, and I didn't learn until later that Clayton had just started working with Wade, and he was helping Wade, sponsoring Wade, and they didn't have any. Clayton felt, and Wade, after conferencing with Andy, who sent him. They thought there's no way they're going to get me sober, but Clayton wanted to show Wade a bad drunk on the way home. So they'd stop by my place, have a look at me, and then go on the hell home. And I, jokingly say, I was Exhibit A that night to the 12-step call. I thought I was the subject of the 12-step call. 12-step call was Wade and Clayton. I just happened to be an exhibit to that deal. But as it comes to pass, when the time is right, that's good enough. Motive is irrelevant. And the fact that they didn't come to fix me, that they came to fix Wade, is quite acceptable when you don't know that, and they happen to be hanging around saying the buzzwords of the program. And that's what they did. They hung around. We talked the program. And all of a sudden, all the cute-ass remarks I used to make about the program and the snide comments and looking down my nose and everything, it quit. I don't know why. I developed a priceless gift. I was given the priceless gift of willingness. Before, I always wanted to debate and argue about it. But, somewhere on the 18th of October, I was given the gift of willingness. And I say this, again, facetiously, but I really mean it. If they said, John, every Tuesday night, we all like to crawl to a meeting from wherever we live. If you got willingness, you say, well, do we wear knee pads or do we tear up another pair of pants every 2 weeks? You know what I mean? I mean, you're going to crawl, right? Because that's willingness. You know, when willingness wasn't there, I'd say, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. As though the life of an alcoholic is anything but ridiculous, right? But I would argue with them. We don't need to do that, you know. And somewhere near willingness occurred, and I said I was going to do whatever people said to do. These people came into my life, and they started, and I gladly gave them the wreckage of it. You know what I mean? And I was very concerned about losing my wife and my two kids. Now that I'm sober, right? I get sober, and I'm concerned about that again, right? And I had a lot of conversation with my sponsor about that, and we talked about it. He said, John, you may not ever get them back. And he says, you know, and you may lose your job. And the book talks about job or no job, wife or no wife. A man can get sober and be happy, you know, so long as his dependence is upon God and not other people. You know, and he told me that, I believe that. And my sponsor is the type of guy that lives the program. And if you're going to hang around him, he's going to talk the big book. If you hang around him, he's going to say a lot of crap out of the book. And so you either listen and never get to say anything back, or you read the big book, and then you get to say something back. You say some more big book back, you know what I mean? And then after a while, you become obnoxious. No one else wants to be around you, unless they start reading too, you know? And then next thing you know, though, you got a little cluster of people sober spouting off paragraphs, you know, to each other. any event, so that was the 18th of October. By December of that year, Patricia and I are talking civilly to each other. First time in a long time, we actually had a civil conversation. First time in a long time, we actually talked like we actually cared about the other person, as opposed to trying to figure out another way to hurt the other person, you know? And I don't know if people ever really fall out of love. I know they do get tired of getting hurt. And I know so therefore they quit being vulnerable, and maybe that looks a lot like maybe, you know, hatred maybe. Maybe it is, I don't know. But I know that we started talking, and then around Christmas of 1971, Patricia asked me if I'd like to come back home, and I jumped at the chance. And I went back home, and here it is, it's Christmas Eve, it's 1973, I'm sober 3 months, and here I am in my own house, and I feel extremely uncomfortable. What the hell do I do in my house on Christmas Eve if I'm not falling into the tree? You know what I mean? I know how to do that real well. I don't know how to not fall in the tree. And so what I do is what I learned to do over the last 3 months. And it was Christmas Eve, and I said, I got to go to a meeting. And she said, I understand. And so I went down to the Preston group. And that's a habit, I think, that we develop along the way by hanging around this program. You know, we start developing good habits. And as if I develop a good habit like going to a meeting, you know, then when I'm in doubt, I do what I usually do. I do what my habits say to do. And my habits say, John, why don't you go to a meeting when you're in doubt? You know? And so I go to a meeting. You know what? I've never gotten in trouble at a meeting. I've never gotten down here and gotten any kind of a jam. I've only gotten relief when I come out. It was Christmas Eve. I went to a meeting. The speaker was up talking, and he said something pretty significant. He said he had been sober a long time, but success had come his way. And so he had gotten a little bit away from the program, and he was traveling out, I want to say Des Moines, maybe it was Omaha, but one of the two cities, and he came upon an AA meeting quite by happenstance and went in, and they had a little kitchen there, and he was having a cup of coffee in the AA kitchen. And another guy, the only other guy standing in the kitchen, was this guy that he struck up a conversation with, and the guy told him, says, you know, he says, I've been sober 17 days after being drunk 17 months, after being sober 17 years. And he said, I wanted to know what happened. And so I asked him, said, and you guys all know the answer, right? Success came to this guy too, right? And things started going his way, and he didn't need meetings anymore. And he quit going to meetings, and the next thing you know, he quit needing this program, and he quit needing to work the steps, and the next thing you know, he was drunk again, and he's trying to scratch his way back into the program, and he can't do it. And so this guy came. He says, I don't want to be down here on Christmas Eve talking at an AA meeting. I want to be at home on Christmas Eve with my family. He says, but I also know about the guy 17 years, you know, and he got drunk. He says, so when the hand of AA reaches out, he says, I think I need to respond. He says, I also think I need to be with my family. He says, so I'd like to introduce you to my family. And the whole first two damn rows got up, and they all applauded me. But everybody he knew, Christmas Eve, down to Preston, and I was really impressed with that. And I went home, and I told Patricia about it, and we talked some more about it, and we said some neat stuff, and it's been an interesting experience between then and now. You know, the third step of this program, I remember looking at the My sponsor was very impressed with this part in the book that talked about selfishness and self-centeredness, you know, and it goes on and says, that we found is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, we step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation. But invariably, we find that sometime in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later places in a position to be hurt. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will-run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Okay? He was impressed with that. He took my book, his blue pen, and underlined it. You know, why don't you write in your own book? You know, that's my attitude to this thing. I didn't squiggly underline. Wasn't a ruler or anything. Just sloppy ass underlining in my book. And I'm beginning to resentment, and he's making a point, and two ships passing the night. You know, but as time goes by, it occurs to me what he said was revolutionary. I mean, outright revolutionary, because up until the third step, up until selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my troubles, up until that point in time, you're the root of my troubles. And so long as you're the root of my troubles and you keep causing me grief, there's nothing I can do about it but be frustrated and despair. So what do I do when I'm frustrated and despair is I do the only thing I can do, and that's have a drink. You know? But after the third step, when it becomes very clear that you're not the cause of my troubles, that I'm the cause of my troubles, I can quit causing me trouble. That's revolutionary. You know what I mean? For someone like myself. I don't have to do that. I can start not causing me trouble. That's the first thing I do, is I quit stirring up crap. The next thing I do is I start working some of these other steps. I do a fourth step, you know, and I do a fifth step, and I get all this stuff down about myself, you know, all this crap that I've accumulated. I think the term is, we call it baggage today, right? And as Sandy V was talking about, you know, when in the fifth and in the sixth and seventh step of giving this stuff up, you know, and you see the drunk with this big rock in this lake and he's drowning and they're saying, leave go of the rock, you know. And he says, but it's my rock. I understand that. It's my crap, you know what I mean? I'm been, you know, it may look uncomfortable to you, but it's got me this far. You know what I mean? And it's my pain. You know what I mean? And I happen to like my pain. I guess I hung on to it long enough. You know? And so I have this. And then somewhere in 6 and 7, I become entirely ready to remove, have God remove these defects of character. And then I'm willing to let them go because these are the things that are killing me. And it's not the real awful stuff, because a lot of us don't have awful stuff. It's a little bitty crap. It's a little crap like, it's real important for me to be right. I like being right. I would rather be right than happy. You know, and I don't think that's unique to me. I think a lot of people in this room went, oh yeah, I understand that. And so that's important to me. That's a little character defect. Maybe innocent enough, but it caused me a lot of problems at home. I jokingly say, but not so jokingly anymore, I'm obsessive, addictive, and insecure. You know, and these, if you take these kind of qualities to work, you're going to do real well. You're going to propel real hard. You're going to stay late, get there early. You know, and you're going to rise to the top. But if you take that kind of crap home, it causes nothing but problems. You know what I mean? Patricia can't say, John, I'm tired of telling you I love you. Here, I'll write it down. Go read it periodically. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm so insecure that I need constant reassurance. You sure now? I mean, you know, I'm just saying that because you don't hurt my feelings. You know, I mean, it just causes a lot of strain on a relationship, you know, and I'm a possessive person. I heard it jokingly said, alcoholics don't fall in love, we take prisoners. I believe that sometimes, you know. I believe that because I don't want to just be in love with you. I would like to run your mind. I would like you to think the thoughts that I have. And I want you to be happy thinking my thoughts. I don't want you just to be thinking, oh, that's a dumb thought. I don't think I'll think it anymore. Hey, it's good enough for me. You know what I mean? And I would, that's the extent of my possessiveness of people, you know. And you know what? If someone goes Al-Anon after a while, guess what? They don't want anyone thinking for them. And I found that to be very uncomfortable. And it caused a lot of problems at our house. And Patricia decides she wants to go back to school and get her degree. You know, and then I magnanimously consented. And she goes back to get a degree. And then one evening, I had to take this course, but she doesn't get home till like 11 o'clock on Mondays. And I said, Patricia, this is a bad idea. And then, she says, but I need the course to graduate. I'm thinking, so what? Go another year. You know, I mean, and who's going to feed me and the kids? You know, it sounds silly now, doesn't it? All fear sounds silly on Monday morning, you know. But in at 2 in the morning, in your own room in the dark, it makes a lot of sense. And so I was, you know, so I'd say, I'm accusing her of everything. At first, she's kind of like half asking me, you know. But then after a while, you know, she's going to take the course. And I'm really pulling out the stops in this inner relationship warfare. You know, and I accused her of having an affair with the teacher and Denton. Accused her of everything to get her to back off. She says, Johnny, I don't know how to tell you this. I love you. I'm taking the course. What are you going to do to that? That evening, this guy I'm sponsoring, this little puppy I'm working with, comes by to pick me up and says, let me tell you about Patricia. And I laid it into them, and I set it up. And, you know, when we tell a story, we know how to set it up so we get the right response, you know. And this little guy I'm working with says, well, isn't that kind of a compliment, John, that she finally thinks she can leave the kids with you and go off and do anything? I'm thinking, who asked him anyway? I'm telling him something, and he's giving me this crap back, you know. And it occurred to me, though, he's probably telling me the truth, right? You know, and so Patricia took the course. She got an A in the course. We just had two kids at the time, I and my two kids. We would go to Taco Bueno on Monday nights. Doesn't sound like a big deal, but they loved it at the time. As a matter of fact, it's a special time. We still talk and joke about that now. She went off to Denton. I was really afraid of that. I don't know why I was afraid. I guess I was afraid she was going to go off to Denton and just keep going north. I don't know. She came back. And I found out what happened was that someone that I wanted to think for came back and was thinking independently on themselves. What I'm trying to get at is I found out that she became far more interesting of a person that came back than the person that was allowing me to do her thinking for her. And the very thing that I kept wanting to do in that relationship was own control and think far and possess. And she didn't want to do and refused to do and didn't do. The very thing that I was doing was the thing that was killing that relationship and making her uninteresting. And the very thing she kept wanting to do was become independent. And as a result, she became interesting. It's a very frightening experience. It was then for me. And even if you could have told me, said, John, this is how it's going to unfold, leave it alone, John. Let it run. It'll unfold this way, and you'll really be happy. I couldn't have done it. I would have still sat in the middle of the floor with my cup and beat it on the floor, saying, I want my way. You know, and I wouldn't have gotten it, even if I'd known the results was going to be. But anyway, time goes by. We got over that hurdle. I've got to make amends to people that I had harmed through the years, and that included everybody pretty much. I mean, who do you exclude off a list if you're a drinking alcoholic? I just put down everybody I knew. I mean, because if I knew you, I hurt you. I didn't mean to hurt you. It's just how it happened. You know what I mean? And then of course the maintenance steps of 10, 11, and 12. And then our life is getting back together, and Patricia and I, we had two kids when I got sober, and now we have three kids, and it's really been a neat experience in many ways. In many ways, it's been still a frightening experience. It's sort of like I kind of jokingly say it's unexplored territory, you know. Today's unexplored territory. I've never been this many days sober before, you know what I mean? And I still find it a little frightening, and that's why sponsorship, I think, is so critical. My sponsor is often in Lawrence, Kansas, working on an Indian reservation. I guess he feels he needs to do that. I wished he was still in Dallas because I miss this company terribly. We communicate on the phone and we write letters back and forth, and it's good, but it's not like the old days. And I'm a person who has a hard time with change. And there's been a lot of changes in my life, and some that I think were good and some that I think were bad. A year ago my brother was killed as a result of alcoholism. Now my father died of alcoholism, and now my brother's died of alcoholism. I think that's enough. You know, it doesn't have to have any more. It's a powerful disease that exists out there, and we hang around the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, and I can be maybe, you know, I hang around a lot of laughter, and I hang around a lot of people in the solution. And if I'm not careful, I've come to think the whole world's like this. The whole world is in the solution, isn't it? It's not, right? We look at the statistics, and they're still brutal statistics, and it's still 90%+ of the people have this, die from it, and it's very scary in that regard. On the other hand, it's a beautiful way to live. I come into this program, all I had was a lot of crap, and I came into this program, and I brought you my crap. And you people seem to thrive on that, and this experience, strength, and hope exchange that occurs in AA meetings, you know. And I brought the problems, and you brought the experience, strength, and hope, and apparently it seemed like you needed the problems to share your stuff with for you to stay healthy. And in the process, I get healthy. And then in the process, I go out and I meet new people. And then the next thing you know, these new people, they're wanting to go to KIPPS with me, you know, after a meeting. And I say, look, you know, I got you to the program. You know, leave me alone, right? But they tag along, you know, and then they go down to KIPPS, and we have ice cream, you know, and then they keep hanging around, you know. And then the next thing you know, you start looking for them, right? The next thing you know, they got a wife, and they got a couple of kids, too. And you start getting involved with the damn family. You know what I mean? And you think, holy cow, there's a whole group of people out here coming back together as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you just realize the power of this program. And if one's not careful, one's just liable to end up with a friend, you know. And that's what kind of happens, I think, working this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an exciting program as I say, fearful from time to time. I'm not always sure I'm going to like what's coming out the other side of the next cycle of change. I get a little perturbed by growth spurts, you know. I don't do well in them. I look a little awkward and feel a little funny when I'm going through them. But it seems to keep resolving itself. I came in here with a lot of crap, and in order to get rid of the crap, you folks taught me how to live, and it's been delightful. And how do you say thank you to someone who's given you 21 beautiful years? Except thank you.